Accession number 6840, roll number 3.
But in reality, all pay and rations was pooled, so the sick got the same rations and pay, if that's the terminology, as a working person. So I had jobs around the camp for a while, and it was decided that the cholera victims had to be burnt. So Amos Lawton and I went in the jungle collecting dry bamboo, etc., to make these funeral pyres. And the first person I remember burning was a chap called Bryson. And in all innocence, we laid him on his back on the funeral pyre. And of course, the word went round with the Chinese, Annamites, whatever, Javanese, etc., who we worked with, that a white man was going to be burnt. So of course, they came along for the spectacle. We lit the funeral pyre, and once it started to burn, this chappie, he kind of partly sat up, moaned, and turned over onto his tummy. The fact that he moved and made this noise caused a railroad panic amongst the colours that came to watch this carnival, as they termed it. They panicked and run away, and the Japs in turn, thinking they were trying to escape, opened fire on them, which of course only added to the confusion. Needless to say, we never made the same mistake again. When we were burning bodies, we invariably laid them on the chest. We didn't want a repetition of that again, or else, who knows, a stray bullet might have had us on the next funeral pyre. To the best of my recollection, after Tunshan, we moved onto a camp in Tok. I think it was at Intok. I managed to fall off a further railway bridge under construction. I think I was known as the Jap Chitty King, because all in all, I think I fell off 5 railway bridges and fell down 1 railway cutting. This time, the war wound I'd suffered in Singapore, in my fall, I opened the wound and it turned into an ulcer. And this particular day, I felt an awful lot of pain in my leg, and when I took the bit of rag off, I noticed it was walking in maggots. And in my innocence, I jumped to the conclusion it was gangrene, because it was needless to say nothing of the kind. But I dashed off to the MI tent and seen our mutual friend, Amos Lawton, showed him them. So he said, "Oh," he said, "that's nothing." He said, "It's only a blowfly that's landed on your wound. The maggots will do it good, they'll eat it clean." So he got a pair of ladies' eye tweezers and plucked the maggots out, but there was one he just couldn't get at. So he got a small piece of kapok, dipped it in carbolic acid, and shoved it into the hole in my leg, and with a famous remark said, "That'll stop you from farting in church. Yours truly just about beat the world record for the high jump with the pain." Talking of jungle ulcers, the normal procedure we used to partake for doing jungle ulcers was you put some red palm oil around the edge of the ulcer, then you put some carbolic acid inside the ulcer to burn it clear, and then when the patient got the point of screaming with pain, you got an old stirrup pump and flushed it out, the ulcer, with water via the stirrup pump. In a lot of cases, it was surprising how effective it was, and the ulcers eventually healed. It was round about this time that a great speedo began. That what it termed, how it turned out to be, was we had reveille at approximately 5:30 on a morning. We had a tenko about 6 o'clock for the Jap guards. A further tenko at approximately 7 o'clock for the Jap engineers. And off we went to work. And we worked 24 hours, i.e. twice round the clock, before we were relieved by the second shift. And the second shift, of course, done exactly the same, and it was repetitious. 24 hours at work, and for practical purposes, about 12 hours off. Because at that point in time, we never moved camp only after we'd laid 30 kilometres of line, because as I said before, we were the Hammer Gang on the Line Lane, and therefore we were wonderfully well fed. But who, in their same senses, would work 24 hours a day with a fellow stood over you with a bamboo pole, who thought if your back was bent, it should be straight. He straightened it. Vice versa. If it was straight and he thought it should be bent, well, he bent it. That the death roll then became pretty horrific. One of our minor recreations was to go fishing in the river. The Chinese used to supply us with little bits of opium, which we put into a rice ball, dropped it in the river, and of course, the fish promptly eat and came up doped with the opium. So, of course, we supplemented our rations with fresh fish from the river a la opium. As conditions got worse, we were finding more and more difficulty in meeting the number of men that was available to go to work. And at one junction, the Japs stipulated there should be 400 men go to work the following day. And for easy figures, there only could be 320 provided. The others were either too sick or dead. But the famous remark was made, it was 400 men or 400 bodies. So the 320 fit men plus so many sick plus so many corpse made the necessary 400 men. Once the Japanese had decided their face had been saved with the sick and the corpse, they settled for the necessary 320 to fulfil the task of 400 beings. But that was the Japanese mentality. If they stipulated a certain number, irrespective of how the number was obtained, it had to be obtained, and then they in turn would acknowledge whatever we could provide in turn. We passed on from Intok, past various notorious camps where cholera had raged. Taki Nun was one, and Rin Tin was another. To the best of my knowledge, I think Rin Tin, which was a Javanese-Dutch camp, I think, practically speaking, the whole camp had been wiped out with cholera. It was round about this area that there was a chap, I'll only refer to him as Redman, I won't even state his unit. He had cholera, and the Japs had decided to isolate him and shoot him, thinking that it had stopped the spread of cholera. But they were so nervous with the Korean guards that the white rifles now were wavering about. And a certain lieutenant and major volunteered and took rifles, and whether they actually killed the person, but anyway, they fired the rifles. And at a later date, when the war was over, I understand they were put on trial in Bangkok for the murder of this person. But the justices, in the wisdom, decided that the man was dead before the shots were fired. That, of course, is open to conjecture. But it shows the conditions we were under when officers volunteered to shoot a person as to let him, as sooner than let him lie and suffer and perhaps spread the disease. As we moved further on to a camp called Plancassi, conditions were pretty grim, and as I've mentioned before, the 24-hour working shift. And I got to the point that one night I just laid down in the mud and decided that was the end. I could go on no further. But a chap called John Scanlon, who belonged to Middlesbrough and at one point in time lived in Wilton Street, he found me laid in the mud and he grabbed hold of me and said, "Come on, Townie, I can't leave you laid out here." And he put me towards the fire and got me some hot sweet tea. And of course, thereafter, I suppose I must have got a bit more backbone and carried on and, survived to fight another day. But round about that time, one of the favourite cracks of the working party was to me, "Corporal, have you started a new fashion? Do you wear your ribs on the outside now? Because I was so thin, literally speak, you could play a xylophone on my ribs, where previously I used to be a tubby hubby." When we made the final link up from Burma, I think we were in a camp called Concreta. The Japs came along with a band in one of the cattle trucks, and the top notch all came and gave speeches. And I don't know if it was true, but it was allegedly that a golden rivet was driven into spike down the final piece of line. I know that there was celebrations for the Great Link Up. Then afterward, we got jobs maintaining the line, ballasting and respiking different parts and tightening fish plates, etc. But when the monsoons came again, invariably you found that rivers or rivulets appeared that nobody knew existed previous. And it was one of these spots that the railway line had got washed away and just got down to the bedrock. So we had the task, supposedly, of blasting out the bedrock and making a culvert. So what we done was we dammed the river, and then we were going to divert it, and then what we were going to do was to blast out the bedrock. So we got the old hammer and tap going. But when the other lads started to loosen the fish plates to take out that section of line which was suspended in mid-air, the Japs decided that was going to sabotage the Japanese war effort. So instead of letting us do as we pleased, they beat us up. So, of course, we carry out orders as been told. We carried on with hammer and tap, put the gelonite in, and, of course, the Japs promptly blasted out the bedrock, but, naturally, they blasted out the bloody railway line at the same time. Well, that just indicates their stupidity, and yet we, in turn, had to abide by their stupidity, or else get beat senseless for trying to find out the stupidity of what they do. After further falling down a culvert, after further falling down a cutting, I had a nasty laceration. The reason I fell down this cutting was one of the Japs, when we were ballasting the line, gave us this rock to throw down to the ballasting, and I was in such a weakened condition, instead of throwing the rock down, I took myself down along with the rock and got awful lacerations. So I was chased down to Banpong as a case unfit to be working on the railway at that point in time. But being an odd bod, I didn't stay in Banpong very long before I was drafted down to Singapore once again, to River Valley Road. To River Valley Road in Singapore. But please let me digress from there. I forgot to mention the fact that while I was at Banpong for the second visit, we had a one day off in 10, and we had a barber shop set up. And one of the stipulations in the barber shop was that nobody had any pay to pay for shaving or for haircuts, and therefore haircuts and shaves were provided free on the stipulation that the barbers, at their discretion, made you wear a Ronald Coleman moustache. So what you found was a sight each day of approximately perhaps 150-200 men going out to work, each one supporting a Ronald Coleman moustache in various stages of a 10-day growth. But that was one of the lighter sides of Banpong. And the second lighter side was I became quite a decent bridge player. We made our playing cards out of pieces of cardboard which we purloined by fair means or foul. And a chap called Jim Sheel and I, we invented a system which we termed as Archimedes. The whole idea was, providing you had a 7-card suit and 1.5 tricks, you made a bid off the 7-card suit. And sometimes the opposition knees threw a fit. They could be set with ace, king, queen, jack of the suit that we were bidding, a call off, which Dachi, of course, they automatically doubled us. And it was really surprising, in spite of the frailty of a 7-card suit, which could be 7 cards rags, how often you could get a 1 and a 2 call in bridge. But the old saying about bridge, never make your wife your bridge partner, because when you murder her, you can always plead justified homicide. Secondly, never make your bridge partner a friend, because there in turn is like to stab you in the back during some bridge session. When I returned to River Valley Road in Singapore, which was approximately about October 1944, I linked up with some of the old NFs, and they were going on a convoy to Japan. It was codenamed Turkey Battalion, and I would like to have gone with them, but of course, being an oddball just arriving in River Valley Road, I wasn't entertained. Unfortunately for me, from what I can gather, the convoy was intercepted by Yank submarines, and the major part of any friends I had that survived in the NF up to that point in time was either killed or drowned on the convoy. So I became once more a docker cum stevedore on Singapore docks. And one of the jobs we had was to go out in launches to take provisions to a German mothership, who in turn was feeding and supplying a couple of German submarines. And the Germans treated us really well, because I suppose we were Caucasians as opposed to Asiatics. But one particular day, we were working on a coal boat, trimming coal. And the idea is that the grab came across with about 1,500 weight of coal. We got under the scuppers, and the coal was dumped into the centre of the hold, and we in turn, of course, trimmed the coal off. Well, if you can imagine the heat in a hold in a ship in Singapore, trimming coal with the dust flying, the black and white minstrels, which just was nothing on us, that when you finished your shift, you used to come up onto the dock side, and as the ships in the harbour were pumping the water out to the side, we used to stand underneath and have an improvised shower, which of course caused great humour to the Germans, who were watching our discomfort. But a chap called Malcolm Dinning, who had worked in Germany before the war and therefore was quite fluent with the German, made a prophetic statement by saying, although they were laughing at our condition at that point in time, they kind of turned the other way and they in turn be prisoners. And strange to relate, from hearsay, when Germany capitulated in May 45, the Japanese in turn took them prisoner and confiscated the submarines. But this again is only hearsay. While working on the coal boats, trimming the coal, a friend of mine, Doug Cotton, had a misfortune of that when the coal grab came over with some coal on, one of the cables broke and we were showered with approximately 1,500 weight of coal, and he was caught and badly scarred with this coal, which of course he carries to this day, the blue scars, which is caused by being cut with coal. While working on the docks in Singapore this second time round, I must have had a brainstorm. I've seen a Japanese officer, which of course called for us to give a very low bow to, but I totally ignored him. So he came storming across to me, inquiring as to why I hadn't given this bow. And of course, foolishly, I replied to him, "Wakaroo nai," meaning I didn't understand. And of course, in turn, He went berserk, took off his sword in the sheath, and laid across me with the sword still in the sheath. And of course, from that episode, I lost a few teeth. But I really must have been insane for to have courted such hardship for a matter of just bowing to him and having tongue in cheek. But then again, these strange things happen which you just can't put a reason to at the time. In the latter part of January 45, we were collected up in River Valley Road to go on a convoy to Japan. And the boat I had to sail on was called the Der Stromer. It was a Dutch boat being constructed in Britain in about 1904 and been flying in Java. I think there was approximately perhaps 1,200, 1,800 men got on this small coaster. Conditions, well, they just defy description. The toilets or latrines were boxes that were slung on the side of the board, which you climbed over the side to do your business. And conditions were really hellish. But fortunately, one of the chaps I was friendly with was a Jap Toban. In other words, he was like a Japanese servant, and he had access to the cookhouse. They were done reasonably well where the food was concerned. But he had the pleasure of being up on deck when our convoy was intercepted, and to the best of my knowledge, of the 8 boats in the convoy, we were the only survivors. So we made what turned out to be later land. And as we were sailing and we could see land at either side of us, we could also see wrecked planes and sunken ships. And as we approached what turned out to be Saigon later, we heard air raid sirens blow. And I thought, oh, good God, we survived the submarines, but we're going to be blasted now with aircraft. But as it turned out, as we found later, the Japanese operated one half of Saigon docks and abided by Tokyo time. The other half of Saigon docks was operated by the Free French, the Vichy French, beg your pardon, Vichy French. They, in turn, observed Greenwich Mean Time. Therefore, each in turn blew the air raid siren so people which took either Tokyo time or Greenwich Mean Time could check their watches and clocks. So, of course, naturally, we landed quite safely in Saigon, and we found that it really was a rest camp in respect to what we'd already endured before, because the French people themselves were very, very friendly. Our workload was jellyside easier, and of course we had the luxury of electric lights and used troughs of water, because where we were stationed had previously been a French army cavalry barracks, and life in general took an upturn. Some of the jobs I'd done in the short time I stayed in Saigon, which was approximately 6 weeks, I worked on Saigon docks. I worked on job number 3, which was working on the aerodrome, extending the runway, and a chap called Bernard Boyle and I worked mates carrying latolite, which was a red substance, and we worked with anamite labour. And I was known as MacMuck, and he was known as Kupchai. Now, MacMuck Kupchai in Annamite language means thank you very much. So I was thank you, and Kupchai was very much. It was another experience of the degradation that we had to suffer. Anyway, while we were at this short job at Saigon, one of the days we went out to work and the Japs yelled for a Hanshaw, which was a leader. And invariably, nobody wanted to be a Hanshaw because it meant either rewards of cigarettes or else a beating up, whichever way the job went. Anyway, of course, idiot me volunteered to be Henshaw. So after we got the job lined up, I told the Jap that I wanted two men to go to the cookhouse for tea. In my best Japanese, Nima Suijiba Ocha. And after we'd had our Yasmi, you know, sat down, had our cup of tea, etc., he, you know, gave me a cigarette, which I didn't smoke, but I retained. And in the sand, he showed me that Slim was coming through Burma and the Yanks were coming through the Philippines. So he indicated to me that all Horios, which was the Japanese for prisoners of war, had to be executed. But if I, in turn, knocked the bung out of one of these stone traps and laid doggo, when the commotion was over, he'd take me to some friends at Cholon, which was a district of Saigon, and I could testify that he was a good Japanese soldier. But I was that bloody frightened. I seen the camp commandant, which was a Dutchman, and asked him to be on the first draft out of Saigon. But while I was waiting to be moved out of Saigon, we started at night to dig slit trenches, as they termed them, and also a deep gully with machine guns nests at either end of this long defile. And I assume later, which I think to be correct, that if it came to the push, we were going to be kidded that there was an air raid and we had to go to these air raid trenches. But as we went along the defile, I really think that these machine gun posts were going to be utilised for our execution. But of course, that in turn is just sheer surmise. But while we were digging this defile, which of course was in the undercover of darkness, I remember once thinking in the moonlight, how strange, I'm stood in a pool of water. And I had an ache in me big toe, and I bent down and put my finger into this pool of water and tasted it, and I realised how salty it was, that what I'd done, I'd chopped the end off my big toe with a chunko. So of course, there again, you were truly a sick chit. As I say, that must be one of those people that was prone to accidents. One of the humorous happenings I can recall in Saigon, nobody had watches because the Japanese had looted them from us time previous, but there was a certain Major Seakin had a watch which was hung up in the camp, so for what reason I don't know, but people could tell the time if need be. And we had a concert party, and the comedian walked on the stage and putting his hand to his eyes, he came on and said, "Seeking, seeking, seeking. Looking, looking, looking. Time marches on." Some person has stole Major Seeking's watch. So, of course, we had the bad pun of seeking, seeking the watch, which had disappeared. But still, that was just one of the highlights of our humour, and yet at the same time, the low point of degradation when people are stealing the only timepiece there was in the whole camp. A further job I had while I was in Saigon for this short visit, one of the days was we had to go to the Rue Victor Olivier, which was the notorious Red Lamp district of Saigon, and we had to weed the gardens and clean up the houses of ill fame. But the prostitutes there were really good. They were lavish with the cigarettes and sweetmeats and toffees, etc., that although they may have been ladies of the night, the hearts were in the right place as far as we fee pals were concerned. But there was many, many strange happenings in Saigon, of men disappearing over the wire to the French lady friends, of a Japanese sergeant which was homosexual, and his lover disappeared over the wire. And in turn, we nicknamed him Escape Me Never, but he took it so much time.